and pay such an outrageous amount of money simply to play music? Well, some of those who gave their silver were simply the self-indulgent rich. To them, a talent was not a great price to set themselves on such proud display. But serious musicians paid too. If your performance impressed the audience and the owners enough, you were given a token, a tiny set of silver pipes that could be mounted on a pin or necklace. Talent pipes were recognized as clear marks of distinction at most sizable inns within 200 miles of Imre. If you had your set of talent pipes, you were admitted to the Aeolian for free and could play whenever the fancy took you. The only responsibility the talent pipes carried was that of performance. If you had earned your pipes, you could be called upon to play. This was usually not a heavy burden, as the nobility who frequented the Aeolian usually gave money or gifts to performers who pleased them. It was the upper-class version of buying drinks for the fiddler. Some musicians played with little hope of actually gaining their pipes. They paid to play because you never knew who might be in the Aeolian that night listening. A good performance of a single song might not get you your pipes, but it might earn you a wealthy patron instead. A patron.
"You'll never guess what I heard,"
Simon said one evening as we sat on our usual bench in the Pennant Square. We were alone, as Willem was off making eyes at a serving girl at Anchor's.
"Students have been hearing all manner of odd things from mains at night."
"Really?" I feigned disinterest. Simon pressed on.
"Yes. Some say that it's the ghost of a student who got lost in the building and starved to death."
He tapped the side of his nose with a finger like an old gaffer telling a story.
"They say he wanders the halls even to this day, never able to find his way outside."
"Ah."
"Other opinions suggest it's an angry spirit. They say it tortures animals, especially cats. That's the sound the students hear late at night, tortured cats' guts. Quite a terrifying sound, I understand."
I looked at him. He seemed almost ready to burst with laughing.
"Oh, let it out," I told him with mock severity. "Go on, you deserve it for being so terribly clever, despite the fact that no one uses gut strings in this day and age."
He chortled delightedly to himself. I picked up one of his sweet cakes and began to eat it, hoping to teach him a valuable lesson in humility.
"So you're still going at it?"
I nodded. Simon looked relieved.
"I thought you might have changed your plans. I hadn't seen you carrying your lute around lately."
"Not necessary," I explained. "Now that I have time to practice, I don't have to worry about sneaking in a few minutes whenever I can grab them." A group of students passed by. One of them waved to Simon.
"When are you going to do it?"
"This morning," I said.
"So soon?" Sim asked. "It was only 2 span ago that you were worried about being rusty. Has it all come back so quickly?"
"Not all of it," I admitted. "It'll take years for it to all come back." I shrugged and popped the last of the sweet cake into my mouth. "But it's easier again. The music doesn't stop in my hands anymore, it just..." I struggled to explain, then shrugged. "I'm ready." Honestly, I would have liked another month's practice, another year's practice, before gambling away an entire talent. But there was no time. The term was nearly over. I needed money to stave off my debt to Devi and pay my upcoming tuition. I couldn't wait any longer.
"You sure?"
Sim asked.
"I've heard people try for their talent that were really good. Early this term, an old man sang a song about this woman whose husband had gone off to war."
"In the village, Smithy," I said.
"Whatever," Simon said dismissively. "What I'm saying is that he was really good. I laughed and cried and just hurt all over."
He gave me an anxious look.
"But he didn't get his pipes."
I covered my own anxiety with a smile.
"You still haven't heard me play, have you?"
"You know damn well I haven't," he said crossly.
I smiled. I had refused to play for Willem and Simon while I was out of practice. Their opinions were nearly as important as those at the Aeolian. "Well, you'll get your chance this morning," I teased. "Will you come?" Simon nodded.
"Willem too, barring earthquakes or a rain of blood."
I looked up at the sunset. "I should go," I said, getting to my feet. Practice makes the master. Sim waved and I headed to the mess, where I sat down long enough to spoon up my beans and chew through a flat piece of tough grey meat. I took my small loaf of bread with me, drawing a few odd looks from the nearby students. I headed to my bunk and retrieved my loot from the trunk at the foot of the bed. Then, given the rumors Sim had mentioned, I took one of the trickier ways onto the roof of Maine's, shimmying up a series of drain pipes in a sheltered box alley. I didn't want to draw any extra attention to my nighttime activities there. It was fully dark by the time I made it to the isolated courtyard with the apple tree. All the windows were dark. I looked down from the edge of the roof, seeing nothing but shadows.
Aori! I called. Are you there?
You're late, came the vaguely petulant reply. I'm sorry, I said. Do you want to come up tonight?
A slight pause.
No. Come down.
There's not much moon tonight, I said in my best encouraging tones. Are you sure you don't want to come up?
I heard a rustle from the hedges below, and then saw Aori scamper up the tree like a squirrel. She ran around the edge of the roof, then pulled up short a few dozen feet away. At my best guess, Aori was only a few years older than me, certainly no more than 20. She dressed in tattered clothes that left her arms and legs bare, was shorter than me by almost a foot. She was thin. Part of this was simply her tiny frame, but there was more to it than that. Her cheeks were hollow and her bare arms waifishly narrow. Her long hair was so fine that it trailed her, floating in the air like a cloud. It had taken me a long while to draw her out of hiding. I suspected someone was listening to me practice from the courtyard, but it had been nearly two span before I caught a glimpse of her. Seeing that she was half-starved, I began bringing whatever food I could carry away from the mess and leaving it for her. Even so, it was another span before she had joined me on the roof as I practiced my lute. The last few days she'd even started talking. I'd expected her to be sullen and suspicious, but nothing could be further from the truth. She was bright-eyed and enthusiastic. Though I couldn't help but be reminded of myself in Tarbin when I saw her, there was little real resemblance. Aori was scrupulously clean and full of joy. She didn't like the open sky or bright lights or people. I guess she was some student who had gone cracked and run underground before she could be confined to Haven. I hadn't learned much about her, as she was still shy and skittish. When I'd asked her name, she bolted back underground and didn't return for days. So I picked a name for her, Aori, though in my heart I thought of her as my little moon fae. Aori came a few steps closer, stopped, waited, then darted forward again. She did this several times until she stood in front of me. Standing still, her hair spread in the air around her like a halo. She held both her hands in front of her, just under her chin. She reached out and tugged my sleeve, then pulled her hand back.
What do you bring me?
She asked excitedly. I smiled.
What did you bring me?
I teased gently. She smiled and thrust her hand forward. Something gleamed in the moonlight.
A key,
she said proudly, pressing it on me. I took it. It had a pleasing weight in my hand. It's very nice, I said. What does it unlock?
The moon,
she said, her expression grave. That should be useful, I said, looking it over.
That's what I thought, she said. That way, if there's a door in the moon, you can open it.
She sat cross-legged on the roof and grinned up at me.
Not that I would encourage that sort of reckless behavior.
I squatted down and opened my loot case.
I brought you some bread.
I handed her the loaf of brown barley bread wrapped in a piece of cloth, and a bottle of water.
This is very nice as well,
she said graciously. The bottle seemed very large in her hands.
What's in the water?
She asked as she pulled out the cork and peered down into it.
Flowers, I said. And the part of the moon that isn't in the sky tonight. I put that in there too.
She looked back up.
I already said the moon,
she said with a hint of reproach. Just flowers, then. And the shine off the back of a dragonfly. I wanted a piece of the moon, but blue dragonfly shine was as close as I could get. She tipped the bottle up and took a sip.
It's lovely,
she said, brushing back several strands of hair that were drifting in front of her face. Aori spread out the cloth and began to eat. She tore small pieces from the loaf and chewed them delicately, somehow making the whole process look genteel.
I like white bread,
she said conversationally between mouthfuls. Me too, I said as I lowered myself into a sitting position, when I can get it. She nodded and looked around at the starry night sky and the crescent moon.
I like it when it's cloudy too, but this is okay. It's cozy, like the underthing.
Underthing? I asked. She was rarely this talkative.
I live in the underthing,
Aori said easily.
It goes all over.
Do you like it down there? Aori's eyes lit up.
Holy God, yes, it's marvelous. You can just look forever.
She turned to look at me.
I have news,
she said teasingly. What's that? I asked. She took another bite and finished chewing before she spoke.
I went out last night.
A sly smile.
On top of things.
Really? I said, not bothering to hide my surprise. How did you like it?
It was lovely. I went looking around,
she said, obviously pleased with herself.
I saw Elodine.
Master Elodine? I asked. She nodded. Was he on top of things too? She nodded again, chewing. Did he see you? Her smile burst out again, making her look closer to 8 than 18.
Nobody sees me. Besides, he was busy listening to the wind.
She cupped her hands around her mouth and made a hooting noise.
There was good wind for listening last night,
she added confidentially. While I was trying to make sense of what she'd said, Aori finished the last of her bread and clapped her hands excitedly.
Now play,
she said breathlessly.
Play, play.
Grinning, I pulled my lute out of its case. I couldn't hope for a more enthusiastic audience than Aori. Chapter 54 A Place to Burn.
You look different today,
Simon observed. Willem grunted in agreement. I feel different, I admitted. Good, but different. The three of us were kicking up dust on the road to Imre. The day was warm and sunny, and we were in no particular hurry.
You look calm,
Simon continued, brushing his hand through his hair. I wish I felt as calm as you look. I wish I felt as calm as I look, I mumbled. Simon refused to give up.
You look more solid, he grimaced. No, you look tight.
Tight? Tension forced laughter out of me, leaving me more relaxed.
How can someone look tight?
Just tight, he shrugged.
Like a coiled spring.
It's the way he's holding himself, Willem said, breaking his usual thoughtful silence. Standing straight, neck unbent, shoulders back.
He gestured vaguely to illustrate his points.
When he steps, his whole foot treads the ground, not just the ball as if he would run, or the heel as if he would hesitate. He steps solidly down, claiming the piece of ground for his own.
I felt a momentary awkwardness as I tried to watch myself, always a futile thing to attempt. Simon gave him a sideways look.
Someone's been spending time with Puppet, haven't they?
Willem shrugged a vague agreement and threw a stone into the trees by the side of the road.
Who is this puppet you two keep mentioning? I asked, partly to draw the attention away from myself. I'm about to die of terminal curiosity, you know?
If anyone could, it would be you, Willem said. He spends most of his time in the archives,
Sim said hesitantly, knowing that he was touching on a sore subject.
It would be hard to introduce you since... you know.
We came to Stonebridge, the ancient arch of grey stone that spanned the Omethi River between the university and Imre. Over 200 feet from one bank to another, and arching more than 60 feet at its peak,
Stonebridge had more stories and legends surrounding it than any other university landmark.
Spit for luck,
Willem urged, as we began to climb one side and followed his own advice. Simon followed suit, spitting over the side with a childlike exuberance. I almost said, luck has nothing to do with it, Master Arwill's words repeated sternly 1,000 times in the Medica. I tasted them on the tip of my tongue for a minute, hesitated, then spat instead. The Aeolian lay at the heart of Imre, its front doors facing out onto the city's central cobblestone courtyard. There were benches, a few flowering trees, and a marble fountain misting water over a statue of a satyr chasing a group of half-clothed nymphs whose attempt at flight seemed token at best. Well-dressed people milled around, nearly a third carrying some sort of musical instrument or another. I counted at least 7 lutes. As we approached the Aeolian, the doorman tugged at the front of a wide-brimmed hat and made a nodding bow. He was at least 6.5 feet tall, deeply tanned and muscular.
That would be 1 jot, young master,
he smiled as Willem handed over a coin. He turned to me next with the same sunny smile. Looking at the loot case I carried, he cocked an eyebrow at me.
Good to see a new face. You know the rules?
I nodded and handed him a jot. He turned to point inside.
You see the bar?
It was hard to miss 50 feet of winding mahogany that curved through the far end of the room.
See where the far end turns toward the stage?
I nodded.
See him on the stool? If you decide to try for your pipes, he's the one you want to talk to. Name's Stanchion.
We both turned away from the room at the same time. I shrugged my lute higher onto my shoulder.
Thank you.
I paused, not knowing his name.
Theok.
He smiled again in his relaxed way. A sudden impulse seized me, and I held out my hand.
Diok means to drink. Will you let me buy you one later?
He looked at me for a long second before he laughed. It was an unrestrained, happy sound that came leaping straight from his chest. He shook my hand warmly.
I just might add that.
Diok released my hand, looking behind me.
Simon, did you bring us this one?
He brought me, actually.
Simon seemed put out by my brief exchange with the doorman, but I couldn't guess why.
I don't think anyone can really take him anywhere.
He handed a jot to Diok.
I'll believe that,
Diok said.
There's something about him I like. He's a little fey around the edges. I hope he plays for us tonight.
I hope so too,
I said, and we moved inside. I looked around the Aeolian as casually as I could manage. A raised circular stage thrust out from the wall opposite the curving mahogany bar. Several spiraling stairways led to a second level that was much like a balcony. A smaller third level was visible above that, more like a high mezzanine circling the room. Stools and chairs, ringed tables throughout around the room. Benches were recessed into niches in the walls. Sympathy lamps were mixed with candles, giving the room a natural light without fouling the air with smoke.
Well, that was cleverly done.
Simon's voice was brittle.
Merciful Taylor, warn me before you try any more stunts, will you?
What? I asked.
The thing with the doorman?
Simon, you are jittery as a teenage whore.
He was friendly. I liked him. What's the harm in offering him a drink?
Diok owns this place,
Simon said sharply.
And he absolutely hates it when musicians suck up to him. 2 span ago, he threw someone out of here for trying to tip him.
He gave me a long look.
Actually threw him, almost far enough to make it into the fountain.
Oh, I said, properly taken aback. I snuck a look at Diok as he bantered with someone at the door. I saw the thick muscles in his arm tense and relax as he made a gesture outside.
Did he seem upset to you?
I asked.
No, he didn't. That's the damnedest thing.
Willem approached us.
If the two of you will stop fish-waving and come to table, I will buy the first drinks, Clint.
We made our way to the table Willem had picked out, not too far from where Stanchion sat at the bar.
What do you want to drink?
Willem asked as Simon and I sat down and I settled my loot case into the 4th chair.
Cinnamon mead,
Simon said without stopping to think.
Girl,
Willem said in a vaguely accusatory way and turned to me. Cider, I said, soft cider.
Two girls,
he said, and walked off to the bar. I nodded towards Stanchion.
What about him?
I asked Simon.
I thought he owned the place.
They both do. Stanchion handles the music end of it.
Is there anything I should know about him? I asked, my near catastrophe with Diok having sharpened my anxiety. Simon shook his head.
I hear he's cheerful enough in his own right, but I've never talked with him. Don't do anything stupid, and everything should be fine.
Thanks, I said sarcastically, as I pushed my chair back from the table and stood. Stanchion had a medium build and was handsomely dressed in deep green and black. He had a round, bearded face and a slight paunch that was probably only noticeable because he was sitting. He smiled and motioned me forward with the hand that wasn't holding an impressively tall tankard.
"Ho there," he said cheerily. "You have the hopeful look about you. Are you here to play for us tonight?"
He raised a speculative eyebrow. Now that I was closer, I noticed that Stanchion's hair was a deep, bashful red that hid if the light struck him the wrong way.
"I hope to, sir," I said, "though I was planning to wait for a while."
"Oh, certainly. We never let anyone try their talents until the sun is down."
He paused to take a drink, and as he turned his head, I saw a golden set of pipes hanging from his ear. Sighing, he wiped his mouth happily across the back of his sleeve.
"What do you play, then, lute?"
I nodded.
"Have any idea what you'll use to woo us?"
That depends, sir. Has anyone played the Lay of Sasavian Trailyard lately?"
Stanchion raised an eyebrow and cleared his throat. Smoothing his beard with his free hand, he said,
"Well, no. Someone gave it a whirl a few months ago, but he bit off more than he could swallow whole. Missed a couple of fingerings, then fell apart."
He shook his head.
"Simply said, no, not lately."
He took another drink from his tankard and swallowed thoughtfully before he spoke again.
"Most people find that a song of more moderate difficulty allows them to showcase their talent," he said carefully.
I sensed his unspoken advice and was not offended. Sir Savian is the most difficult song I had ever heard. My father had been the only one in the troupe with the skill to perform it, and I had only heard him do it perhaps 4 or 5 times in front of an audience. It was only about 15 minutes long, but those 15 minutes required quick, precise fingering that, if done properly, would set 2 voices singing out of the lute at once, both a melody and a harmony. That was tricky, but nothing any skilled lutist couldn't accomplish. However, Sasavian was a ballad, and the vocal part was a counter-melody that ran against the timing of the lute. Difficult. If the song was being done properly, with both a man and a woman alternating the verses, the song was further complicated by the female's counter-harmony in the refrains. If it is done well, it is enough to cut a heart. Unfortunately, few musicians could perform calmly in the center of such a storm of song. Stanchion drank off another solid swallow from his tankard and wiped his beard on his sleeve.
"You singing alone?"
he asked, seeming a bit excited in spite of his half-spoken warning.
"Or have you brought someone to sing opposite you? Is one of the boys you came in with a castrati?"
I fought down laughter at the thought of Willem as a soprano and shook my head.
"I don't have any friends that can sing it. I was going to double the third refrain to give someone the chance to come in as Halloween."
"Trooper style, eh?"
He gave me a serious look.
"Son, it's really not my place to say this, but, do you really want to try for your pipes with someone you've never even practiced with?"
It reassured me that he realized how hard it was going to be.
"How many pipes will be here tonight, roughly?"
he thought briefly.
"Roughly? 8, maybe a dozen."
"So in all likelihood there will be at least 3 women who've earned their talents."
Stanchion nodded, watching me curiously.
"Well,"
I said slowly,
"if what everyone has told me is true, if only real excellence can win the pipes, then one of those women will know Halloween's part."
Stanchion took another long, slow drink, watching me over the top of his tankard.
When he finally set it down, he forgot to wipe his beard.
"You're a proud one, aren't you?"
he said frankly. I looked around the room.
"Isn't this the Aeolian? I had heard that this is where pride pays silver and plays golden."
"I like that,"
Stanchion said almost to himself.
"Plays golden."
He slammed his tankard down onto the bar, causing a small geyser of something frothy to erupt from the top.
"Damn it, boy, I hope you're as good as you seem to think you are. I could use someone else around here with Ilion's fire."
He ran a hand through his own red hair to clarify his double meaning.
"I hope this place is as good as everyone seems to think it is,"
I said earnestly.
"I need a place to burn."
"He didn't throw you out,"
Simon quipped as I returned to the table.
"So I'm guessing it didn't go as badly as it could have."
"I think it went well," I said distractedly, "but I'm not sure."
"How can you not know?"
Simon objected.
"I saw him laugh. That must mean something good."
"Not necessarily,"
Willem said.
"I'm trying to remember everything I said to him," I admitted. "Sometimes my mouth just starts talking and it takes my mind a little bit to catch up."
"This happens often, does it?"
asked Willem with one of his rare, quiet smiles. Their banter began to relax me.
"More and more often," I confessed, grinning.
We drank and joked about small things, rumors of the masters and the rare female students who caught our attention. We talked about who we liked in the university, but more time was spent mulling over who we didn't like and why, and what we would do about it given the chance. Such is human nature. So time passed, and the Aeolian slowly filled. Simon gave in to Willem's taunting and began to drink scutton, a powerful black wine from the foothills of the Shaldar Mountains, more commonly called Cuttail. Simon showed the effects almost immediately, laughing louder, grinning wider, and fidgeting in his seat. Willem remained his same taciturn self. I bought the next round of drinks, making it large mugs of straight cider for each of us. I responded to Willem's scowl by telling him that if I made my talent tonight, I would float him home in Cuttail. But if either of them got drunk on me before then, I would personally thrash them and drop them in the river. They settled down an appreciable amount and began inventing obscene verses to Tinker Tanner. I left them to it, retreating into my own thoughts. At the forefront of my mind was the fact that Stanchion's unspoken advice might be worth listening to. I tried to think of other songs I could perform that were difficult enough to show my skill, but easy enough to allow me room for artistry. Simon's voice drew me back to the here and now.
"Come on, you're good at rhymes,"
he urged me. I replayed the last bit of their conversation that I'd been half listening to.
"Try In the Telin's Cassock," I suggested disinterestedly. I was too nervous to bother explaining that one of my father's vices had been his propensity for dirty limericks.
They chortled delightedly to themselves while I tried to come up with a different song to sing. I hadn't had much luck when Willem distracted me again.
"What?"
I demanded angrily. Then I saw the flat look in Willem's eyes that he only gets when he sees something he really doesn't like.
"What?"
I repeated more reasonably this time.
"Someone we all knew and love,"
he said darkly, nodding in the direction of the door. I couldn't see anyone I recognized. The Aeolian was nearly full, and over 100 people milled about on the ground floor alone. I saw through the open door that night had settled outside.
"His back is to us. He's working his oily charm on a lovely young lady who must not know him. To the right of the round gentleman in red,"
Willem directed my attention.
"Son of a bitch,"
I said, too stunned for proper profanity.
"I've always figured him for porcine parentage myself,"
Willem said dryly. Simon looked around, blinking owlishly.
"What? Who's here?"
"Ambrose."
"God, balls,"
Simon said and hunched over the tabletop.
"That's all I need. Haven't you two made nice yet?"
"I'm willing to leave him be," I protested, "but every time he sees me, he can't help but make another jab in my direction."
"It takes two to argue,"
Simon said.
"Like hell,"
I retorted,
I don't care whose son he is. I won't go belly up like some timid pup. If he's fool enough to take a poke at me, I'll snap the finger clean off that does the poking.
I took a breath to calm myself and tried to sound rational.
Eventually, he'll learn to leave me well enough alone.
You could just ignore him,
Simon said, sounding surprisingly sober.
Just don't rise to his baiting and he'll tire of it soon enough.
No,
I said seriously, looking Simon in the eye.
No, he won't.
I liked Simon, but he was terribly innocent at times.
Once he thinks I'm weak, he'll be on me twice as thick as the day before. I know his type.
Here he comes,
Willem observed, looking casually away. Ambrose saw me before he made it to our side of the room. Our eyes met, and it was obvious that he hadn't expected to see me there. He said something to one of his ever-present group of bootlickers, and they moved off through the crowd in a different direction to claim a table. His eyes moved from me to Willem, to Simon, to my loot, and back to me. Then he turned and walked to the table his friends had claimed. He looked in my direction before he took his seat. I found it unnerving that he didn't smile. He had always smiled at me before, an oversad pantomime smile with mockery in his eyes. Then I saw something that unnerved me even more. He was carrying a sturdy, squared case. Ambrose plays liar? I demanded of the world in general. Willem shrugged. Simon looked uncomfortable.
I thought you knew,
he said weakly.
You've seen him here before?
I asked. Sim nodded.
Did he play?
Recited, actually. Poetry. He recited and kind of plucked at the lyre.
Simon looked like a rabbit about to run.
Does he have his talent?
I said darkly. I decided then that if Ambrose was a member of this group, I didn't want anything to do with it.
No,
Simon squeaked.
He tried for it, but...
He trailed off, looking a little wild around the eyes. Willem lay a hand on my arm and made a calming gesture. I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and tried to relax. Slowly, I realized that none of this mattered. At most, it simply raised the stakes for tonight. Ambrose wouldn't be able to do anything to disrupt my playing. He would be forced to watch and listen. Listen to me playing the lay of Sir Savian Trelliard, because now there was no question as to what I would be performing tonight. The evening's entertainment was led by one of the talented musicians from the crowd. He had a lute and showed that he could play it as well as any Edema Rue. His second song was even better, one that I'd never heard before. There was a gap of about 10 minutes before another talented musician was called onto the stage to sing. This man had a set of reed pipes and played them better than anyone I had ever heard. He followed by singing a haunting eulogy in a minor key. No instrument, just his high, clear voice that rose and flowed like the pipes he had played before. I was pleased to find the skill of the talented musicians to be everything it was rumored to be. But my anxiety increased a proportionate amount. Excellence is excellence's only companion. Had I not already decided to play the lay of Sir Savian Trelliard for purely spiteful reasons, these performances would have convinced me. There followed another period of 5 or 10 minutes. I realized that Stanchion was deliberately spacing things out to give the audience a chance to move about and make noise between the songs. The man knew his business. I wondered if he had ever been a trooper. Then we had our first trial of the night. A bearded man of 30 years or so was brought onto the stage by Stanchion and introduced to the audience. He played flute, played it well. He played 2 shorter songs that I knew and a third I didn't. He played for perhaps 20 minutes in all, only making 1 small mistake that I could hear. After the applause, the flautist remained on stage while Stanchion circulated in the crowd gathering opinions. A serving boy brought the flautist a glass of water. Eventually, Stanchion came back onto the stage. The room was quiet as the owner drew close and solemnly shook the man's hand. The musician's expression fell, but he managed a sickly smile and a nod to the audience. Stanchion escorted him off the stage and bought something that came in a tall tankard. The next to try her talent was a young woman, richly dressed with golden hair. After Stanchion introduced her, she sang an aria in a voice so clear and pure that I forgot my anxiety for a while and was ensnared by her song. For a few blessed moments I forgot myself and could do nothing but listen. Too soon it was over, leaving me with a tender feeling in my chest and a vague prickling in my eyes. Simon sniffled a little and rubbed self-consciously at his face. Then she sang a second song while accompanying herself on a half-harp. I watched her intently, and I will admit that it was not entirely for her musical ability. She had hair like ripe wheat. I could see the clear blue of her eyes from where I sat some 30 feet away. She had smooth arms and small, delicate hands that were quick against the strings. And the way she held the harp between her legs made me think of, well, the things that every boy of 15 thinks about incessantly. Her voice was as lovely as before, enough to set a heart aching. Unfortunately, her playing could not match it. She struck wrong notes halfway through her second song, faltered, then recovered before she made it to the end of her performance. There was a longer pause as Stanchion circulated this time. He milled through the three levels of the Aeolian, talking with everyone, young and old, musician and not. As I watched, Ambrose caught the eye of the woman on stage and gave her one of his smiles that seemed so greasy to me and so charming to women. Then, looking away from her, his gaze wandered to my table and our eyes met. His smile faded, and for a long moment we simply watched each other, expressionless. Neither of us smiled mockingly or mouthed small, insulting nothings to the other. Nevertheless, all our smouldering enmity was renewed in those few minutes. I cannot say with certainty which of us looked away first. After nearly 15 minutes of gathering opinions, Stanchion mounted the stage again. He approached the golden-haired woman and took her hand as he had the previous musicians. The woman's face fell in much the same way his had. Stanchion led her from the stage and bought her what I guessed was the consolation tankard. Closely on the heels of this failure was another talented musician who played fiddle, excellent as the two before him. Then an older man was brought onto stage by Stanchion as if he were trying for his talent. However, the applause that greeted him seemed to imply that he was as popular as any of the talented musicians who had played before him. I nudged Simon. "Who's this?" I asked, as the grey-bearded man tuned his lyre.
"Threep,"
Simon whispered back at me.
"Count Threep, actually. He plays here all the time, has for years, great patron of the arts. He stopped trying for his pipes years ago. Now he just plays. Everyone loves him."
Threep began to play, and I could see immediately why he had never earned his pipes. His voice cracked and wavered as he plucked his lyre. His rhythm varied erratically, and it was hard to tell if he struck a wrong note. The song was obviously of his own devising, a rather candid revelation about the personal habits of a local nobleman. But in spite of its lack of classic artistic merit, I found myself laughing along with the rest of the crowd. When he was done, everyone applauded thunderously, some people pounding on the tables or stamping as well. Stanchion went directly onto the stage and shook the Count's hand, but Threep didn't seem disappointed in the least. Stanchion pounded him enthusiastically on the back as he led him down to the bar. It was time. I stood and gathered up my loot. Willem clapped my arm, and Simon grinned at me, trying not to look almost sick with friendly worry. I nodded silently to each of them as I walked over to Stanchion's vacant seat at the end of the bar where it curved toward the stage. I fingered the silver talent in my pocket, thick and heavy. Some irrational part of me wanted to clutch it, hoard it for later. But I knew that in a few more days a single talent wouldn't do me a bit of good. With a set of talent pipes, I could support myself playing at local inns. If I was lucky enough to attract the attention of a patron, I could earn enough to square my debt to Devi and pay my tuition as well. It was a gamble I had to take. Sanchin came ambling back to his spot at the bar.
I'll go next, sir, if it's all right with you.
I hoped I didn't look as nervous as I felt. My grip on the loot case was slippery from my sweating palms. He smiled at me and nodded.
You got a good eye for a crowd, boy. This one's ripe for a sad song. Still planning on doing Savian?
I nodded. He sat down and took a drink.
Well then, let's just give them a couple of minutes to simmer and get their talking over with.
I nodded and leaned against the bar. I took the time to fret uselessly about things I had no control over. One of the pegs on my lute was loose and I didn't have the money to fix it. There had not been any talented women on stage yet. I felt a twinge of unease at the thought of this being the odd night where the only talented musicians at the Aeolian were men, or women who didn't know Alouin's part. It seemed only a short time before Stanchion stood and raised a questioning eyebrow at me. I nodded and picked up my lute case. It suddenly looked terribly shabby to me. Together we walked up the stairs. As soon as my foot touched the stage, the room hushed to a murmur. At the same time, my nervousness left me, burned away by the attention of the crowd. It has always been that way with me. Off stage, I worry and sweat. On stage, I am calm as a windless winter night. Stanchion bade everyone consider me as a candidate for my talent. His words had a soothing, ritual feel. When he gestured to me, there was no familiar applause, only an expectant silence. In a flash, I saw myself as the audience must see me. Not finely dressed as the others had been, in fact, only one step from being ragged. Young, almost a child, I could feel their curiosity drawing them closer to me. I let it build, taking my time as I unclasped my battered second-hand lute case and removed my battered second-hand lute. I felt their attention sharpen at the homely sight of it. I struck a few quiet chords, then touched the pegs, tuning it ever so slightly. I fingered a few more light chords, testing, listened, and nodded to myself. The lights shining onto the stage made the rest of the room dim from where I sat. Looking out, I saw what seemed to be a thousand eyes. Simon and Willem, Stanchion by the bar, Diok by the door. I felt a vague flutter in my stomach as I saw Ambrose watching me with all the menace of a smoldering coal. I looked away from him to see a bearded man in red, Count Threep. An old couple holding hands, a lovely dark-eyed girl. My audience. I smiled at them. The smile drew them closer still, and I sang.
Still, sit, for though you listen long, long would you wait without the hope of song so sweet as this. Azilian himself said down an age ago, masterwork of a master's life of Savian and Alouin, the woman he would take to wife.
I let the wave of whisper pass through the crowd. Those who knew the song made soft exclamation to themselves, while those who didn't asked their neighbors what the stir was about. I raised my hands to the strings and drew their attention back to me. The room stilled, and I began to play. The music came easily out of me, my lute like a second voice. I flicked my fingers, and the lute made a third voice as well. I sang in the proud, powerful tones of Savian Trailyard, greatest of the Amir. The audience moved under the music like grass against the wind. I sang as Sir Savian, and I felt the audience begin to love and fear me. I was so used to practicing the song alone that I almost forgot to double the third refrain.
but I remembered at the last moment in a flash of cold sweat.
This time, as I sang it, I looked out into the audience, hoping at the end I would hear a voice answering my own. I reached the end of the refrain before Aloine's first stanza. I struck the first chord hard and waited as the sound of it began to fade, without drawing a voice from the audience. I looked calmly out to them, waiting. Every second a greater relief vied with a greater disappointment inside me. Then a voice drifted onto stage, gentle as a brushing feather, singing.
Savian, how could you know? It was the time for you to come to me. Savian, do you remember the days we squandered pleasantly? How well, then, have you carried what have tarried in my heart and memory?
She sang as Aloine, I as Savian. On the refrains her voice spun, twinning and mixing with my own. Part of me wanted to search the audience for her, to find the face of the woman I was singing with. I tried once, but my fingers faltered as I searched for the face that could fit with the cool moonlight voice that answered mine. Distracted, I touched a wrong note, and there was a burr in the music. A small mistake. I set my teeth and concentrated on my playing. I pushed my curiosity aside and bowed my head to watch my fingers, careful to keep them from slipping on the strings. And we sang. Her voice like burning silver, my voice an echoing answer. Savian sang solid, powerful lines like branches of a rock-old oak, all the while Aloine was like a nightingale, moving in darting circles around the proud limbs of it. I was only dimly aware of the audience now, dimly aware of the sweat on my body. I was so deeply in the music that I couldn't have told you where it stopped and my blood began. But it did stop. Two verses from the end of the song. The end came. I struck the beginning chord of Savian's verse and I heard a piercing sound that pulled me out of the music like a fish dragged from deep water. A string broke. High on the neck of the lute it snapped and the tension lashed it across the back of my hand, drawing a thin, bright line of blood. I stared at it numbly. It should not have broken. None of my strings were worn badly enough to break, but it had. And as the last notes of the music faded into silence, I felt the audience begin to stir. They began to rouse themselves from the waking dream that I had woven for them out of strands of song. In the silence, I felt it all unraveling. The audience waking with the dream unfinished, all my work ruined, wasted. And all the while burning inside me was the song. The song. The song. Without knowing what I did, I set my fingers back to the strings and fell deep into myself. Into years before, when my hands had calluses like stones and my music had come as easy as breathing. Back to the time I had played to make the sound of wind turning a leaf on a lute with six strings. And I began to play. Slowly, then with greater speed as my hands remembered, I gathered the fraying strands of song and wove them carefully back to what they had been a moment earlier. It was not perfect. No song as complex as the Savian can be played perfectly on six strings instead of seven, but it was whole, and as I played, the audience sighed, stirred, and slowly fell back under the spell that I had made for them. I hardly knew they were there, and after a minute I forgot them entirely. My hands danced, then ran, then blurred across the strings as I fought to keep the lute's two voices singing with my own. Then, even as I watched them, I forgot them. I forgot everything except finishing the song. The refrain came and Aloine sang again. To me, she was not a person or even a voice. She was just a part of the song that was burning out of me. And then it was done. Raising my head to look at the room was like breaking the surface of the water for air. I came back into myself, found my hand bleeding and my body covered in sweat. Then the ending of the song struck me like a fist in my chest, as it always does, no matter where or when I listen to it. I buried my face in my hands and wept. Not for a broken lute string and the chance of failure. Not for blood shed and a wounded hand. I did not even cry for the boy who had learned to play a lute with six strings in the forest years ago. I cried for Sir Savian and Aloween. For love lost and found and lost again, at cruel fate and man's folly. And so for a while, I was lost in grief, and knew nothing. Chapter 55 Flame and Thunder. I held all of my mourning for Savian and Aloween to a few moments. Knowing I was still on display, I gathered myself and straightened in my chair to look out at my audience. My silent audience. Music sounds different to the one who plays it. It is the musician's curse. Even as I sat, the ending I had improvised was fading from my memory. Then came doubt. What if it hadn't been as whole as it had seemed? What if my ending hadn't carried the terrible tragedy of the song to anyone but myself? What if my tears seemed to be nothing more than a child's embarrassing reaction to his own failure? Then, waiting, I heard the silence pouring from them. The audience held themselves quiet, tense, and tight, as if the song had burned them worse than flame. Each person held their wounded selves closely, clutching their pain as if it were a precious thing. Then there was a murmur of sobs released and sobs escaping, a sigh of tears, a whisper of bodies slowly becoming no longer still. Then the applause. A roar like leaping flame, like thunder after lightning. Chapter 56 Patrons, Maids, and Metheglin. I restrung my lute. It was a fair distraction while Stanchion gathered opinions from the crowd. My hands went through the routine motions of stripping the broken string away while I fretted to myself. Now that the applause had died, my doubts had come to plague me again. Was one song enough to prove my skill? What if the audience's reaction had been due to the power of the song rather than my playing of it? What of my improvised ending? Perhaps the song had only seemed whole to me. As I finished removing the broken string, I gave it an idle look, and all my thoughts fell to a jumble at my feet. It wasn't worn or flawed as I had thought it would be. The broken end was clean, as if it had been cut with a knife or snipped with a pair of scissors. For a while, I simply stared at it, dumbly. My lute had been tampered with? Impossible, it was never out of my sight. Besides, I had checked the strings before I left the university, and again before I had come on stage. Then how? I was running the thought in circles in my head when I noticed the crowd quieting. I looked up in time to see Stanchion take the last step onto the stage. I hurriedly got to my feet to face him. His expression was pleasant, but otherwise unreadable. My stomach tied a knot as he walked towards me. Then it fell as he held out his hand the same way he had held it out for the other two musicians who had been found wanting. I forced my best smile onto my face and reached to take his hand. I was my father's son and a trooper. I would take my refusal with the high dignity of the Adema Ru. The earth would crack and swallow this glittering, self-important place before I would show a trace of despair. And somewhere in the watching audience was Ambrose. The earth would have to swallow the Aeolian, Imre, and the whole Kenthe Sea before I gave him a grain of satisfaction over this. So I smiled brightly and took Stanchion's hand in my own. As I shook it, something hard pressed into my palm. Looking down, I saw a glimmer of silver. My talent pipes. My expression must have been a delight to watch. I looked back up at Stanchion. His eyes danced and he winked at me. I turned and held my pipes aloft for everyone to see. The Aeolian roared again. This time it roared a welcome.
"You have to promise me,"
a red-eyed Simon said seriously,
"that you will never play that song again without warning me first. Ever."
"Was it that bad?" I smiled giddily at him.
"No!"
Simon almost cried out.
"It's... I've never..."
He struggled, wordless for a moment, then bowed his head and began to cry hopelessly into his hands. Willem put a protective arm around Simon, who leaned unashamedly against his shoulder. "Our Simon has a tender heart," he said gently. I imagine he meant to say that he liked it very much. I noticed that Willem's eyes were red around the edges too. I lay a hand on Simon's back. "It hit me hard the first time I heard it too," I told him honestly. "My parents performed it during the midwinter pageantry when I was 9, and I was a wreck for 2 hours afterwards. They had to cut my part from the swineherd and the nightingale because I wasn't in any shape to act." Simon nodded and made a gesture that seemed to imply that he was fine, but that he didn't expect to be able to talk any time soon, and that I should just carry along with whatever it was I was doing. I looked back at Willem. "I forgot that it hit some people this way," I said lamely.
"I recommend Scotton," Willem said bluntly. "Cocktail if you insist on the vulgar, but I seem to remember you saying that you would float us home tonight if you got your pipes, which may be unfortunate, as I happen to be wearing my lead drinking shoes."
I heard Stanchion chuckle behind me.
"These must be the two non-castrati friends, eh?"
Simon was surprised enough at being called a non-castrati to collect himself slightly, rubbing his nose on his sleeve. "Willem, Simon, this is Stanchion." Simon nodded. Willem gave a slight stiff bow. "Stanchion, could you help us to the bar? I've promised to buy them a drink." Willem said.
"Drinks.
Sorry, drinks," I stressed the plural.
"I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them."
"Ah," Stanchion said with a grin. "Patrons, I understand completely."
The victory tankard turned out to be the same as the consolation one. It was ready for me when Stanchion finally managed to get us through the throng of people to our new seats at the bar. He even insisted on buying Scutton for Simon and Willem, saying that patrons have some claim to the spoils of victory as well. I thanked him earnestly from the bottom of my rapidly thinning purse. While we were waiting for their drinks to come, I tried to peer curiously into my tankard, and found that doing so while it was sitting on the bar would require me to stand on my stool.
"Metheglin,"
Stanchion informed me.
"Try it, and you can thank me later. Where I'm from, they say a man will come back from the dead to get a drink of it."
I tipped an imaginary hat to him.
"At your service."
"Yours and your family's,"
he replied politely. I took a drink from the tall tankard to give myself a chance to collect my wits, and something wonderful happened in my mouth. Cool spring honey, clove, cardamom, cinnamon, pressed grape, burnt apple, sweet pear, and clear well water. That is all I have to say of metheglin. If you haven't tried it, then I'm sorry, I cannot describe it properly. If you have, you don't need me to remind you what it's like. I was relieved to see the cocktail had come in moderately sized glasses, with one for Stanchion too. If my friends had received tankards of the black wine, I would have needed a wheelbarrow to get them back to the other side of the river.
"To Sevian!"
Willem toasted.
"Hear, hear!"
Stanchion said, lifting his own glass.
"Sevian!"
Simon managed, his voice sounding like a stifled sob. "And Halloween," I said, and maneuvered my great tankard to touch glasses with them. Stanchion drank off his scutton with a nonchalance that made my eyes water.
So, he said, before I leave you to the adulation of your peers, I have to ask,